on our agenda after our call to order is a review of the agenda. I just wanted to alert everyone to the fact that we will be receiving a presentation from CAPS, the superintendent's organization, from Fran Rabinowitz. Fran is going to be joining us around 11:15. So to the extent that the agenda items, we can get through as much of our agenda before 11:15, I'll be skipping around a little bit on the agenda to get our other work done as we wait for Fran to join. So just with that in mind, the next item would be to approve the draft minutes of our January 8th regular meeting. Do I have a motion on that?
So moved.
Moved by Sam Gold. Second?
Second, Lyle Ray.
Lyle Ray has a second. Any comments on those minutes or any changes that anyone may be proposing? Okay, if not, I'll try your minds. All those in favor of the minutes, please signify by saying aye. Or aye. By raising your hand. Okay. It looks like it's unanimous, except is there anyone opposed, just to be clear?
Abstaining. I wasn't present.
And Deborah was not there. Brian, you're...
I will abstain as well. I was not there.
Okay. Thank you for that. Anyone else? Okay. So that motion is passed. The minutes are approved. Our next item on the agenda is a request to consider a proposal for county equivalency among our planning regions. And this is a request that I know Sam has been heavily involved in, and I don't want to take up any more time trying to describe it. I think I'd leave it to Sam to lay it out. You all, I think, should have gotten a summary of the proposal within the last couple of days. But Sam, why don't I let you take it over and explain it?
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also want to recognize Dan Morley from OPM, Undersecretary Martin Heft, and Francis Pickering for their work on this as well, as well as cooperation from the governor's office, the CT Data Collaborative, and CTCOG and the Census Bureau. So this is an idea that's been many years in the making. The concept is that in 1960, when county government was abolished, the state of Connecticut never officially provided a forwarding address to the Census Bureau saying, okay, well, you know, we recognize that on the federal level there are things for counties, and we don't have counties anymore. But this is the closest thing we got, is these planning regions. So in Connecticut statutes, there are already statutes that support COGS receiving grants that would otherwise go to counties, and we are empowered with a long list of about 25 different regional services that are very similar, akin to what counties can do in other places. Of course, we aren't county government, and that's not changing. But for purposes of towns working together in federal programs, it'd be very convenient to have that recognition. But furthermore, just more basically, it will help us do our basic planning work at the COG level. Right now, the 2020 census is you know, being all calculated and tabulated, and we're going to get results that are going to be along the historic county lines of Connecticut, and very little in Connecticut is oriented along those lines. My region luckily does cover all of Middlesex County, so those numbers are useful, but we do have two towns in New London County. In my old region, in the Narthex Valley, that region has parts of four counties. It doesn't have the largest municipality in any of them, and the county data, which is on the federal level, which is incredibly valuable data, whether it's county business patterns or the agricultural census or all the Bureau of Labor Statistics, all those data sets are pretty useless for, like, let's say a region like the Narthex Valley, because the county data just doesn't represent that planning region. So initially, this is going to be very much about data. As this works through the system, the proposal is to not have this go into effect until 2023. After all the census products are completed, so it won't interrupt any of that process. And then the first census that would actually use the planning regions as a county equivalent wouldn't be until 2030. So there's plenty of time to figure out if there are any impacts that work through them. But what we're excited about is that it will allow towns to work together through their COGS in more ways that are potentially recognized by the federal government. I think the best example I have for how this make things easier is right now our COGS prepare and update our natural hazard mitigation plans. And these are the plans that FEMA doesn't mandate, but really likes towns to have to prepare for disasters and avoid hazards that we know exist. We do these projects on a regional level, but when it comes to adoption, it has to be an individual town by town adoption of the regional document. In the future, it might be a simpler process. But along those lines, the way it works in other parts of the country is that cities and towns can do their own thing if they want, but if they want to work on a regional application, they can. I know Dan is on the call. I don't know if he wants to add anything to this or any of the other COG directors. But the proposal is out in the Federal Register for public comment, that closes on the 12th. So since this is the Advisory Commission on Intergovernmental Relations, and this is a change in it's not really a change in anything in Connecticut statutes. It just is sort of a official informing of the federal government that, hey, we have these things called COGS and planning regions, and where applicable, use them instead of historic county governments that don't exist. So I don't know, Dan, if you have anything to add.
Yeah, just if anyone wants to look at any of the background information, it is on OPM's website. If you just search for Councils of Governments, the information will come up. It includes all of the background correspondence from Secretary McCaw to the U.S. Census Bureau, as well as State Data Center support. And again, we're hoping to have as much letters of support for this by the February 12th deadline. And then the Census Bureau will consider all that it has received, and we'll be in communication with them to find out what the rollout time will be. But Sam summed up what the intent is, and we're happy to take any questions. I noticed Martin is on.
Yeah, Martin, did you want to add anything?
Good morning, all. Sorry, I had difficulty getting logged in this morning for some odd reason, but so apologies for coming in late. And Sam, Dan, thanks for recapping it. I kind of came in partway through it. I was just add that, you know, obviously the COGS, all the municipal leaders already know about all of this because they've already supported it throughout this entire process. So everyone really should have the information and the knowledge of this because it's not a new item that's come up. It's been a long time in the process as we've been going through all of this. Municipal officials have voted in their regional COG levels on this about moving this forward and everything. So, you know, I just reiterate, you know, that piece of it, and would love to have, you know, ACIR's support on this as well moving forward. As noted, I'm sure that, you know, basically looking at this as the county equivalent, it's for, you know, the statistical data information there being able to be, you know, compiled everything at that level, as that's the way a lot of our stuff is done because we don't have county governments. You know, there are, you know, potential side benefits of all this as well, as, you know, as I'm sure has been discussed. So there's a lot of great potential there. The governor, you know, is behind this, as well as, you know, the administration, OPM, as, you know, has been stated.
Mr. Chair?
Thanks, Martin. Lyle, I was going to ask if you had a
Yep, thank you. Well, having run a county, I know what they are. Just a couple of things. Yesterday, the Regional Plan Association of New York City went to a great deal of trouble and issued a really neat affordable housing report based on counties. So we got to take it apart and put it into COGS. So this is the point, I think, that not only for the purpose of census, but we can get Homeland Security and everyone else to begin to think in COG terms. So that's, I think, a very important point. The second thing is we're not exactly rushing at this since counties were abolished in 1961. I think I was still on my tricycle then. So it's not exactly, early to do this. And the last point I think about this, I was on a planning and development committee meeting the other day, and a legislator was basically implying that counties actually boss around cities and towns. Well, they don't. They're a co-equal level of government. So state, regional, counties, and cities and towns are not in a hierarchy in the sense that the state runs all of it. But just people don't need to panic about what counties actually do. I had 10 cities that would, sort of tell me exactly what counties could or couldn't do. So anyway, I'd like to make a motion that ACIR endorse the proposal, or the, a letter of support to the federal regulations in support of the county equivalents.
And second. Second that.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Further conversation, discussion about the motion? I don't know if any of the other COG directors have anything to add.
I see Francis is on. Francis and his staff were instrumental in getting this off the ground initially. He had a
1962, I think.
Yes, Tom. Thank you. We are very excited about this. It's been a long-term priority. I think we're actually coming up and having been talking about this for a decade. So it's wonderful to have so much support around the state. We're excited about the data, but we're also excited about the fact that this will ultimately enable municipalities collectively to apply for federal funds. Right now, in many cases, they cannot do so. The COGs are not recognized by federal agencies in many cases as an eligible grantee. And we believe that applying to things jointly will help us achieve economies of scale and efficiencies, not only in the application process, but also position us to be more competitive against large cities, metro areas, and counties around the country. So we support this.
Thanks, Francis. Could I also just ask, for the record, I think I know the answer to the question, but I think we all do. But for the record and for those who may be observing this from a distance, this is not a proposal to create county government in Connecticut.
No. Right? This does nothing to change anything in Connecticut statutes. It changes nothing of home rule. It just is informing the Census Bureau that the closest thing that we have in Connecticut to counties is really the planning regions, which the current planning regions were established in a process that actually was started while you were speaker about 10 years ago, and every town, a number of towns, not every town, a number of towns came together and created our existing planning regions. I would argue that our planning regions are more rational and more functional, larger amalgamations of towns than our historic counties, which, the reason why Lyme and Old Lyme are in New London is because there wasn't a bridge across the river 200 years ago. Now it makes more sense for them to be with Old Saybrook than to be with New London. Those types of changes, I think, will be beneficial in the future. But it doesn't change anything in statutes or the relationships of the towns. And I think one thing that's really important to underscore, which I think Lyle touched upon, is that the chief elected officials of the towns run the COGs. So, the COG directors are all staffed to the CEOs, and we report to them. So unlike a county somewhere else, there is no additional layer of government. It's really just the chief elected officials cooperating amongst themselves and working together. Yep. And working together when it makes sense. And when it doesn't make sense, they go their own way.
Maybe just one point more. Oh, go ahead, John.
John?
Yeah, just for the record, this has historically been a CCM issue too, and they have endorsed this. It has historically been on their legislative program. So the Connecticut Conference of Municipalities has been back this concept.
Great.
Maybe just one point that, if I could just add to that, Francis made, but I want to underscore it. It doesn't impose county government, and county government doesn't impose anything on town. So if you want me to go off on that, I can tell you there's a misunderstanding here that counties are some kind of, you know, heavy duty group that would boss cities and towns around. That's for people that have never worked in a county and city government. It doesn't work that way. But the other point I think is the sub-state units for federal funds is very important. And I think that over time will happen, which is just as counties get allocations for Homeland Security or other things, the COGS will at least show up as a sub-state unit. We're kind of invisible. And I think that's a point that will happen over time. It's not going to happen instantly. So the census is one thing, and then other allocations from federal governments might start showing up in terms of emergency management or other aspects directly to COGS. So I think that's just that's a long-term deal. It's not going to happen instantly, but I just wanted to add that, underscore what Francis had said.
Yeah. And this, my own comment is that this shows what a geek I am. When I was in law school, my closing thesis for one of my land use classes was on the history of planning regions in Connecticut post-county. And, you know, they were originally formed when we abolished counties. The planning regions were formed to be able to accept federal DOT money, transportation money.
Right.
That was at the core of their purpose.
Yep.
And so that they could receive money for interstate highways and those kinds of things in a way that we otherwise couldn't because we didn't have counties. And we had 15 of them originally. And then, about 10 years ago, we consolidated them down to 9. So that's a much more manageable size. And it does make sense that for census.
It was also housing money back then, too.
Yeah.
1995 and other things. So there was transportation and housing money, which is a really good reason to do the planning regions for sure.
Yeah. Exactly. Sam?
And I'll just make a note of the passing of Horace Brown, who was instrumental in setting up those planning regions all those years ago. So it's sad news for anyone who knew of him and his work in Connecticut. It literally changed the landscape and created our planning regions. So it's a loss to the state.
Yeah, amen. That's a good mention. Thank you, Sam. Any other comments about the motion that's in front of us? If not, let me try your minds. All those in favor of the motion to approve this recommendation to the U.S. Census Bureau, please indicate by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Any abstentions? Okay, so that passes unanimously. So we'll add that. We'll figure out, Bruce and Sam, we'll have to figure out how to formally do that. We'll put together a letter, I'm assuming, and for Lyle and I to sign. Is that the appropriate protocol?
I think so. I can work with Bruce. And I think what's important here is communicating to the Census Bureau, to the Federal Register, that ACIR is the commission that's empowered to on issues regarding intergovernmental relations. So this is the most appropriate state body to sort of weigh in on this proposal, in my opinion.
Great. Good. Well, I'm glad we're doing it. All right. Thanks all on that. So again, let's move on to item 6 on our agenda, beginning with, which is old business, but beginning with the policy studies from UConn and University of Georgia.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if I could kick it off and then turn it over to John Elsesser because we have a new study that's been submitted.
Yeah.
Just to refresh your memories, because this has been rattling around for a bit. We have 4 studies involved in this project. Best practices reviews, and I think I'm the co-father with John Filchuk on that one. But looking at the model of Massachusetts of local government best practices and grants to implement it. It's not best practices in the sense of executive orders, but best practices for local government services, such as snow and ice removal. So best practices is one. The second that's complete also is the shared services report. Was a broader look at how to do shared services. It wasn't a repetition of all the work you did, Mr. Chair, on Moore and others, but it was a look broader in a broader fashion about how to advance shared services. And the one that is not yet complete, and we had to get a substitute UConn intern, is the use of advanced information technology to facilitate state and local government. Kylie Booley is the person who will be working on that in UConn. So that one's in process. And then the final one that maybe John can speak to is local government revenues. But just to wrap up, the option here is to provide webinars on each of these studies over time, compose, have the presenter who wrote the paper, and then have a panel and reactors. So we have a natural place to slot this. CROG and the University of Connecticut Public Policy Center, Connecticut City Managers Association, and the Connecticut chapter of American Society for Public Administration have been doing a series of webinars. So we've got half a dozen of these under our belt already. So we would be happy to do all that and do all the work. I just wanted to mention that. But there's probably a 6 to 8 week lead time to compose a webinar, get it out there, publicize, and so on, just to let you know. So my suggestion is the first one we do is with Ryan Miller from the University of Georgia on best practices. But I just wanted to give you that as a heads up. So maybe, John, you want to speak to Ilka's paper?
Sure. And Francis, please kick in if I go too far astray. Francis and I both mentored Ilka. Ilka is from Finland. He's actually has a doctorate in sociology and is now trying to go and get a master's degree in public administration, too. So I think if you've had a chance to look through the report, you'll see the citations of an academic research project, which is very helpful for the state of Connecticut. So I'm going to go very quickly through a couple key points in the executive summary. It talks about how our Connecticut's slow economic growth is also has really high income disparities, and our population is shrinking. So we know it's no surprise to us that we have income issues. But he pointed out, also not a surprise, that we have exceptionally high reliance on property taxes and very low reliance on user fees and other charges. So specifically, 86% of our own source revenues are come from property tax, which you know, puts us really at the highest levels in the nation in reliance on property taxes. And conversely, we're the second lowest in the use of other source revenues like user fees. In looking at some of the things, Ilka, you know, relied on a lot of the research that was done as part of the Connecticut tax panel and other sources, but did recognize that user fees, you do have to be careful about the vertical inequities, that user fees can adversely impact people of lower income, but so do property taxes, especially things like car taxes. So we had five recommendations of targeted user fees to establish stormwater drainage utilities. That's specifically very important due to federal regulations and changes to something called MS4, where towns have to go out and identify discharges and do routine maintenance. And very expensive mandate. It's not currently applicable to all Connecticut towns and cities. It's more urban areas, or an urban area can be somewhat surprising. That's a federal designation. So even a small town of Bolton is an urban area. So MS4 is one of them. Looking at breaking out services from property tax structures. And I think we're going to look at some statewide initiatives to do pay-as-you-throw for trash collection as that type of issue. Re-examine existing user fees. Anecdotally, some fees that are in place, the towns actually lose money on. And I will cite dog licenses, as Ilka did, as an example of that. Towns lose money on every dog license because the fees have remained so low. And it's basically a fee that towns shouldn't do anymore. Should basically be tied to rabies vaccinations and done by vets. Get out of the business. So when you create user fees, you need to have a mechanism to make sure that the basis of the fee is keeping up with the cost of collecting it. Secondly, he also propose that we start looking at user fees for electric vehicles. Obviously, will be an emotional issue, but the reality is that they don't pay gas taxes, and since we don't have tolls, that somebody has to pay to repair roads. And at some point, as things continue, we really need to look at coming up a way that the people with electric vehicles also pay their fair share. Finally, we also wanted to look at certain school activity fees, and there's some right now for school sports or field trips, et cetera, but looking at maybe reducing the cost of schools through appropriate user fees that could also be subsidized through programs like recognizing school lunch kids as getting subsidies or free. And part of that is some of these outside activities also go into the MBR formula that then set you know, base levels. So you may have a trip to China in the next year that's being subsidized by the district, and the next year that's built at the base of the school system and should be segregated out. So those, and the last recommendation I think is maybe the most important. There is not a good source of data statewide on what user fees are. Every town collects their own fees, and there's no repository to say this. You know, what should a building permit be? What other towns are charging? There is no one place that has a list of what the user fees are by all the towns. And that, I think, is a very important, not a high-cost thing to do, to create an inventory of user fees that we can see and track those over time. So I don't know how much more you want to go through, but those are the core recommendations. There's a lot of really interesting comments and about who we are and how we relate to the world in terms of user fees and the possibilities of what user fees could do to lower property taxes. If we collected the same level of user fees as South Dakota, there could be up to a 12% reduction in property taxes. That's a stunning number. Now, the reality is ILCA also states that we're really probably in Connecticut talking about nibbling at the edges and would not have a real significant issue, but it would look at a way of not having property taxes continue to increase. So at that point, I think, you know, ILCA would be willing to participate in one of these seminars. But Francis, do you have anything else to add?
No, thank you, John. I think you summarized it perfectly. But, you know, I think the biggest issue here really is that we are such an extreme outlier in terms of how reliant we are on the property tax. And for me personally, just getting information about what the user fees are, as far as I'm aware, there's only one municipality in the entire state that has a comprehensive fee schedule across all of its departments for every single service or function. Just getting that information could go a long way to helping us understand what fees can be increased to help offset the property tax burden, and sometimes perhaps what fees could be decreased to be more economically competitive. So there's a lot of research to be done in bringing data together, but it's a great start.
Thank you. Thanks, Francis. Thanks, John. Can you just also just, I know Lyle touched on this, can you remind us of what the time frame would be for the group to see the draft and prior to an actual presentation or a webinar format?
So the report was actually distributed with the agenda. So you know, people can look at it. But Lyle, in terms of time frames, that's up to you.
Just, I think Ricard wants to be recognized, but just very quickly, Mr. Chair, the reports up to date that are complete have been provided to the entire group. The one that's missing is the advanced IT, which is not yet written. But before we leave today, I wanted to basically get the consensus of the ACIR to proceed with UConn to set up the webinars. You know, I'm not trying to exclude cooks from the kitchen, but if people really want to get involved and do some of the work, feel free to contact me. But the idea would be to, and there's a 6 or 8 week lead time. The first one on shared services, it's already been before you. done by Ryan Miller of University of Georgia, would be a 90-minute format, PowerPoint presentation, a panel, and a reactor. And I would plan to do that with UConn, as we've done with a number of things. Professor Al-Qadri, you met before on this topic. So if there's a, I don't know if there's any concern about doing that, I'd just as soon proceed and plunge on. To the extent that there are others that want to get involved, feel free to just contact me. Otherwise, I will plunge on with the first one anyway, and we can go from there. But there are four to go, a total of four, I should say. I just wanted to add that. Is there any concern about me doing that, or does somebody else want to do it?
Before we answer that question, though, let me just get Rick's hand up. Rick, did you have some input?
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chairman. I just had a quick question. I had to step away. Has there been any discussion, John, with the group on user fees on nonprofits for municipalities?
It's mentioned a little bit, and it takes both sides of that. That you have to be careful about, the side benefit, side impacts, the negative impacts. Unintended, so there's a discussion of both sides of the, of that. That while if they get free services from a town, then it's actually raising everyone else's property taxes, but there's also social good for that. So it is discussed within the report and doesn't take a stand that it should be looked at, that it should be just eliminated. But there are some issues where some of the nonprofits maybe should pay for some services that they don't. And trash is always an example. In some areas, water and sewer are actually included in property taxes, and those should maybe be isolated out, depending like other places do, by metered service. So you have incentive to be careful with the use of those issues. So it's discussed in it, but it doesn't take a strong stance that charging user fees for nonprofits is the right thing to do. It says it has to be viewed carefully on a case-by-case basis.
Thanks, John. Rick, is that?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. John Filchek.
Thank you. And just a question for John. I've read through the report quickly, and it is impressive. My question is, in doing the work, were shared or regional services looked at in the context of the study, and also did an examination of shared revenue between municipalities be explored?
I think the simple answer is no. Really was looked at more as a town by town. It was user fees generically and not specifically either regional or town. So we didn't focus on that that aspect, and maybe should have. I don't know. Francis, you got anything to add to that?
No, I don't. Obviously, there may be some savings through economies of scale at a regional level, but that's really a separate issue. That's not so much a revenue issue. It's more of a efficiency of operations issue, which, of course, has an impact on how much revenue you have to raise. So it's related, but not exactly what Ilka was looking at.
Yeah, since you brought up dog licenses, we take, revenues related to dogs for our regional program and put it into a common pot, and that helps keep those costs for that program for the whatever 19 or 20 towns down. So I think that may be an element of a further study that we ought to go down is to look at revenue sharing and the impact, and shared and regional services related to it.
Okay, thanks, John. Anyone else with a comment? Bob?
Just a quick question for clarification. As we talk about, user fees, is it anticipated within the report that user fees would reduce property taxes or be implemented to reduce the increase in property taxes? particularly, you know, how would our residents see differences in their property taxes, short-term or long-term?
I think the recognition was that, you know, it's not going to have a significant, it's not going to be like the North Dakota, South Dakota, where it's a 12% reduction. But you get into some of the larger programs like trash, if that's in your tax base now, then that is an area of significant potential reduction. In our town, in the mid-90s, we separated trash out, and that's basically a 1 mil savings to our taxpayers by having a user fee for that. And it's variable waste. So it's, you know, you pay for what you throw. So you have an incentive to recycle versus toss everything in the bin. So not significant, Bob. Trash would be probably the largest of them. But in some cases, like MS4, I think it would be more a prevention from increasing property taxes.
Thanks, John. Any other questions or comments?
Yes, just one comment. You know, one thing we haven't looked at, which may come up in the future, is historically, a lot of services were folded into the property tax because they were federally tax advantaged that way. So you get, you know, a 25, 30, 35% real discount on those services. That's partly why we see so many special taxing districts. Obviously, with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2018, which imposed a $10,000 cap on the state and local tax deduction, a lot of the justification for folding things into taxes has evaporated. And so you may actually see savings by moving into a user fee and as a Pigovian tax, encouraging people to moderate their consumption. The big wild card here is whether Congress will abolish the $10,000 salt cap. And if that happens, I think we have to have a discussion about how that interacts with any of the effects of a user fee in moderating consumption.
It's a great point. I've been watching that closely myself as to whether the feds are with a new administration and new majorities in both houses, if the salt is going to come back. The lifting of the cap on salt is going to mm-hmm. Connecticut.
Yeah, and one thing you can do is you can have hybrid models where, say, if you had trash collection, a certain amount, one can, for instance, is included in your tax, and you go above that, and that's a user fee. So there are a lot of models out there that if this does go back to unlimited deductions, we could look at, but that's all hypothetical right now.
Sure. And, you know, not to belabor it, but, obviously in Connecticut, the future of trash in Connecticut is also suspect right now. So that's timely to be considered. Any other thoughts or comments? Because I did want to get back to Lyle's request that and get the consensus of the group. Lyle, can you just repeat what you were asking of the group again? Sorry.
Sure. Happy to do so. So we're going to have a total of four studies for ACIR. Three are done. One is in works. The advanced IT study has not been completed. Kylie Booley at UConn is doing that. My proposal was that we start with the shared services paper, which looks at local government best practices and how it might be done based somewhat on the Massachusetts model. To have Ryan Miller from the University of Georgia present it, have a panel react to it on the webinar, and do that in partnership with University of Connecticut's Public Policy Program, Dr. Al-Qadri, and we've added Connecticut City Managers and the American Society for Public Administration Connecticut chapter. So I guess the sense of the ACIR like is I'm happy to proceed with doing that if others want to volunteer to help me. Otherwise, we have kind of a working process with the University of Connecticut Public Policy Program to sort of describe these things, mount them, and get them going. So I guess, is that an appropriate course of action? Anybody have any concerns? I'd just like to get the show on the road if you're all up for that.
Is there anyone who feels otherwise or is concerned about that? If I don't think so, it makes sense to me. So I think, Lyle, that's an affirmative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yep, and feel free if you want to get involved, just give me a buzz or we'll talk.
Great, okay. Thank you, Lyle. I see that we've been joined by Fran Rabinowitz for our at precisely on time at the 11:15. Before we jump to Fran, there is an important item connected to old business that I was hoping we could get to before Fran, but that's the about the local government of the future and overviews and the status of things. We have an update on the governor's budget that's coming out on Wednesday that will, as I think I just kind of confirmed this morning, and I think Martin can jump in as well on that, that it will be included, our proposal with regard to the RPIP changes and incenting COGS and RESCs to perform shared services at their level. That proposal will be in the governor's budget on Wednesday. But we also have the other proposal that we still have kind of hanging out there with regard to allowing boards of ed to collaborate, for lack of a better way of describing the initiative. There are some language tweaks that have been going on, but we are needing to get that done so we can get it to the chairs of the Planning and Development Committee as soon as possible. I was just contacted last week by the House chair to asking for where that legislation is so that the committee can raise it. So we do have work to do after Fran's presentation, so I'd ask if everybody can sit tight once Fran is completed, and then we can get back to that business and finish up our agenda. So with that, Fran, welcome. Glad to have you joining us, and we'll hand it over to you.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for allowing me to be here today. I'm greatly appreciative, and thank you, Maureen, for bringing me into this. And I see many names that are very familiar to me, but certainly Brendan and Carl Amento. I was superintendent in Hamden for 7 years and worked very closely with both of them. And I'm just so pleased to be able to share our proposal with you. It's been in the works for 3 years. Many of you will know Ted Sergi, who was the past commissioner, and also spent a great deal of time in putting together the ECS formula. And I approached Ted 3 years ago when I became the executive director for superintendents and asked him if he would work on a funding proposal with me, along with Kathy Gay, who was a former officer of the Office of Policy and Management. And to my relief, Ted agreed. And the genesis of why I wanted that funding proposal was two things. First of all, CGEF had fallen off and not been successful in the way we hoped. But also, the ECS formula was going forward and 95 school districts were losing dollars under ECS that I felt could ill afford to lose them. You know, places like Colchester, Milford, Stratford, et cetera. It wasn't just the Darien's or the New Canaan's of the world, but school districts that vitally needed those dollars were going to lose them. So Ted and I and Kathy began working that summer, and we quickly realized that we wanted something very different than just a new ECS formula. We wanted an ECS formula in the context of education programs. And so what you have, what has evolved, is a 30 recommendation proposal going forward, a 15-year plan for education in Connecticut. We call it a CAPS blueprint to transform Connecticut's public schools. And I'm going to give you a very high level view of this because I know you're very busy and I don't want to take all your time, but I want you to know that I am available at any time, and there's certainly no audience more important than you and would love to get your support for this. So we begin certainly by talking about ECS and talking about the fact that the state needs to make the pie bigger, stop robbing from Peter to pay Paul. The actual pie for ECS needs to be larger. And we're saying you've been at 41, between 39 and 41% for 30 years. That's how much of the district proportion of expenses you're paying. Many states are at 47% or at least 50% of the cost of educating a child. So we have a 15-year plan to move to 47%. 40%, 7% would be district, and then 6% would be federal. That's on the state level. And we're saying that our plan is reasonable. It's 2.5% per year. And we're asking also that the foundation of ECS be considered. Right now it's at 11,000. It has no rhyme or reason to the actual cost of educating a child in Connecticut, which the median cost is somewhere around 17,000. We then ask that the ECS funding be put forward for 3 years instead of every year having to worry about ECS funding. Let us know ahead of time so we can budget responsibly. And when you are changing the ECS formula, do it by May so that we can put together our own budgets at the district level. In addition to that, we asked for special ed funding, and we're saying we don't need any fancy collaboratives. We don't need anything other than we need you to fully fund the excess cost. Right now it's funded at about 70%. We need the full funding for that. And at the same time, we're working with our federal delegation to have them make good on their promise of 40% of the special ed costs being paid for by the federal government. I was pleased to see that President Biden is also talking about that and moving that forward. That is basically what we have on funding. And what we realized is that funding by itself and resources by itself are not everything that is going to make children successful in Connecticut. So we're looking at education programming as well. And we are saying that there are many things that could be different. For example, we are talking about school construction. We're saying right now you are reimbursing 10 to 70. We'd like to see that 10 to 80. And greater state requirements on need and justification. We're fine with that. This is not a money-grabbing proposal. We're looking at accountability here. We're also looking at redirecting some dollars that you'll hear me speak about. And we are looking at things that I think are very close to Brendan, I know, and to others, and that's regionalism and how we increase regional efforts. We're also saying adult education, for example, every district in the state is required to have an adult education program or share it with another district. And we're saying, why can't we regionalize that? Why can't it be done at the risks? At least the basic education, the education for second language learners, and the GED. If it were done at the risks, we could save a whole lot of administrative money in each school district and not have to repeat the efforts over and over again. And we're saying the school districts could certainly hold on to the enrichment activities that they offer that do help to make them money. We're looking at English language learners. They're becoming many more students in every district. We're asking for more dollars in that regard. We're asking to add $6 million more for English language learners, because we do believe we need a plan for how soon they will achieve bilingualism. We're talking about early childhood, and there's something very different here. Remember, it's a 15-year plan. It's aspirational. We know that the federal government under this administration will be coming in with more early childhood plans. We're saying we would like the state to commit to offering early childhood for free to all 3- and 4-year-olds who are under the poverty level. And that means not just to the poorest districts, but across the state. We all have them in our school districts, whether or not you might be an alliance district or a priority district. We're looking at transportation. Those districts that have where transportation costs are more than 4% of the general budget, or and above the median cost of transporting a child statewide, we need to reinstitute the transportation grant. Under this as well, we're looking, so those are basically our asks for funding, and they're over 15 years. The first year of the biennium, we're asking for about $78 million. It's not outrageous. I mean, I've been part in my long career of many, many asks that have been astronomical and as a result have gone nowhere. So we feel that we are being very prudent in the dollars that we're asking. And so in the other pieces of this, while the funding is honestly very important, we also need to look at structural racism. And we have lots of recommendations in there for professional development, especially for pre-service, et cetera. We have recommendations for collecting the data, et cetera. We're looking at virtual learning. And we're saying, you know, virtual learning during the pandemic has been with us, has cost districts and municipalities enormous amounts of money. We're not where we want to be with it yet. And it is probably something that will continue on even after COVID. There will be availability of online courses, et cetera. We need to improve it. Here's where we're asking to save money. We're looking at student assessment, the state tests that are given every year. They cost $1 million to $1.5 million per grade level. And we're saying we don't know anything more now in testing all the kids every year than we knew when we tested them every other year. So couldn't we pull back on that and do 3, 5, and 7 and eliminate 4, 6, and 8, which would save us $1 million to $1.5 million per grade level. And we're asking that the PSAT be instated and paid for in grade 9. Many of your districts are paying for that already. It's a valuable test, and leave the SAT in grade 11. We're asking for dollars and programs coming out of SDE. Model curriculum. Let me just say to you, I know you're not educators in the true sense of, you know, teachers, administrators, but let me tell you, your districts are spending a great deal of money in developing a curriculum every year in reading and math and science, social studies, et cetera. It's time for the state to have model curriculum that we can all use and tweak in the ways that we need to for our individual districts. But spending that money, I mean, I spent thousands of dollars as a superintendent to develop curriculum. We could have it at the state level and do it that way. We're asking for to consider the mental health needs of our students. And I sit in Rosa Dolores' kitchen cabinet. I know dollars are coming forward for that. And so we're saying, let's have greater symmetry with our community agencies. And let's also understand that we need more school personnel to deal with the trauma that kids will be bringing as a result of COVID. We're looking at teacher certification, and we're saying, let's streamline it. Let's make it easier to bring in teachers from other states. And we're not lowering standards. We're just saying, let's look at it differently and make it less challenging for our teachers. And within that as well, we're saying we need more teachers of color. Let's look at the RESC Alliance, CREC, that has a great program for elevating paraprofessionals, but it costs money. It costs $65,000 per paraprofessional to become certified while working, and districts can't afford it. So we're asking for more dollars to make that happen. We're saying that there are could be possible savings in teacher retirement. The new teachers coming in today, guys, are not signing in for 37 and a half years. They are saying, maybe I'm going to like teaching, maybe not. Could we have more portable systems and perhaps save money for in retirement? We're saying that there's almost $3 million in state grants that were given to districts as gifts years ago or to programs and just have remained in the education budget. We could remove those and save $2.7 million and put it into teaching and learning. We're looking at regional efficiencies. We're saying that we're supporting a state task force on improved state, municipal, and regional collaboration. We're saying that the RESCs need to become more important in this. They've done some great work, but they need to do, we need them to do more. We may need to fund them where they haven't been funded. The $5 million that they used to receive was taken away, but frankly, they need it to support more and efficient program options so that each district doesn't have to do it. We're saying let's get rid of some of the mandate waivers for the districts that are doing incredibly well or growing. Let's take care of that. If you're an alliance district, many times you have like five or six different grants to fill out. Let's put all the money into one grant and let the district use it as they see fit. We're looking at governance, and we're saying we need a code of conduct for Board of Ed members, and we need the ability to remove a Board of Ed member who is seriously violating that code of conduct. We're looking at public school choice, and we're saying while we agree that magnet schools are wonderful, as are agri-science schools, the way that they are reimbursed is a mess, frankly. Hartford receives far more money than New Haven or Hamden, for example, or Bridgeport. And no other schools of choice should be approved and funded until we figure out how we can more equitably fund them. We're saying, let's be aware that when you cut back municipal funds, like the pilot program or other funding to municipalities, that you indirectly affect education. There's just so much money. Educators and school districts exist within municipalities. If municipalities are cut, education's going to be cut. We're saying that we are more than willing to have public hearings to measure success on how we use our dollars and how we have impacted student achievement and how we have impacted the gaps that exist. And we're saying we can do that each and every year. We're also saying that the state and the municipalities need to have be very public about the debts and obligations that they have each year so that nothing becomes a surprise, such as the state pension at the state level. Not that it was a surprise to many of us, but it did come as a surprise to some. we're saying that, you know, more research is needed. We need to understand better why in one district it costs $38,000 to educate a child and in another district it's $14,000. I think we know the answer to that. It's the number of students within that school district, but more research is needed there. More research is needed on why are the special ed numbers growing exponentially. They were 11% in 2011. They're up to 16% right now. And in many cases, they are at least 25% of the general budget. And we're saying we need to look at that. I have my own thinking on why that is happening. But we need a, and I hate task forces, guys, but we need a task force in this area with timelines and goals for figuring out how we can work on that. So that is basically the plan. It's a 15-year plan. I will tell you that we're closely following the bills that have been raised at the legislature. And believe it or not, most of those bills are included in the plan. And I'm also going to be talking to the governor's office again later today to say, Governor, this would be a great plan for the governor to have for education. It's cohesive. It's long term. And imagine how powerful it could be if we were all working on one plan together. You don't have to agree with everything. It has the full consensus of every superintendent in Connecticut right now. Everyone has bought into the plan. Do we agree with every single piece that's in the plan? No. And we're open to discussion on some of the areas. But if we were working together, I think we could accomplish great things. Massachusetts does this, and they certainly have moved forward in education. What I have seen are a lot of fragmented efforts. And at the legislature every year, I see all of these bills coming in from all over the place. And I just think if we did it in a cohesive manner and knew that that we had a plan over time, it would be incredibly helpful. To date, I haven't gotten anyone to buy in and raise it as a bill. But I'm still hopeful that we'll raise it as a concept. I'm also hopeful that the governor may buy in. But we at CAPS, the superintendents throughout Connecticut, are committed to continuing to work on the plan as we move forward. So that's it. I'm sorry if I talk too much, but please give me your recommendations, questions, et cetera.
Thanks, Fran. Yeah, that's very helpful, and I think it's you provided a great summary of what you are doing. I know for our sake here at ACIR, we have some legislative proposals as well, which is we're straddling with your presentation in today's meeting. But one of the things that I think we've identified right from the get-go was that nothing goes anywhere in Connecticut unless the governor gets behind it. Yep. And if you've got some, big goals, big ambitions, big ideas, the legislature can do a lot. But if you don't have the governor behind you, it's not going to, chances are it's not going to go anywhere. So I'm interested in what is the strategy that CAPS is going to employ to garner support for this. How are you building a coalition of supporters, which may include the ACIR, for example, to get behind it? Are you going straight to I know you've said you're going to the governor for him to endorse it, but what's the implementation strategy?
That's a great question, Brendan. Well, we have several. We are building and trying to build a coalition of supporters. The teacher unions, for example, said they agree with 80% of it. I'm fine with that. Do you know what I mean? They have some questions about the retirement piece and the certification piece. That's okay. but they're generally in support. We have been to CABE. They're in support. We've been to CASBO. And I'm also working. I've attended just about every legislative breakfast. I'm working with the chairs of the Education Committee and with the ranking member very closely. We want to build a coalition. And yes, I am working with the governor's office. And I haven't spoken to the governor himself about the plan, but I have spoken with Jonathan Harris and Mohit Agarwal, who are his policy people, Nick Simmons, Mary Glassman, about it. And they all like the plan. Nobody has said no. They're concerned about the funding. And I have said, you know, I get it. I understand that, and we can work that through. You know, if the funding isn't available in this biennial, we're going to push for it. But if it isn't available, can we at least accept the plan and talk about the funding in 2022? And so they're open to that. The other piece that we are working hard on is a priority list. So what do we need for, what would we like you to work on in 21, 22, and so on, and what could be on the back burner? That has gone over well too. We worked with Ted on that, and we have a Gantt chart looking at that as well. And all of the superintendents are also at the same time meeting with their local legislators to try to build. And I would be open and, you know, would really appreciate any other recommendations that you have.
Well, I don't want to discourage anyone else from offering up some questions. I have a thought about how ACIR might want to proceed, but let me open it up to anyone else who has some questions of Fran while we have her. Lon?
Yeah, Fran, how you doing? I was curious, you know, we were having a discussion in our local board the other day about comparing us to other districts and within some of the things that we do within our group of districts locally. And, you know, it struck me that, you know, we have this uniform chart of accounts, but nothing is really program-based. You know, we don't have a way of really comparing how one district's program compares to another. And what triggered me when you were going through your list of goals was that notion of ECS being tied to programming as opposed to just being money. Yeah. Do you see any changes maybe on the uniform chart of accounts that, you know, might help with these comparatives? Because I agree, the, you know, this notion of being tied to per student costs when you don't look at all the other factors, I think tends to muddy the arguments and muddy some of the policy decisions that we make too.
And Lon, you're absolutely right. And we would certainly be open to looking at the uniform chart of accounts and saying, how could we better do this? And, you know, I date back to the strategic school profiles. And it was the same kind of thing when you try to compare instructional materials, for example. It wasn't always apples to apples. And so I think that is very, very important. I think what's somewhat groundbreaking about this proposal is that it's not looking at the funding in isolation. It's saying we can look at the funding, but we also have to look at how we're doing our programming. I mean, we could save thousands of dollars, guys, if the RESCs were, you know, did a regional effort on adult ed, for example. That could save a lot of money. It could save it in a lot of other areas as well. So, yes, we are, we're definitely looking at that as well, Lon, or would be willing to look at it. It's the first time it's been brought up.
Thanks. And Fran, just so you know, we're, you know, the one of those legislative proposals that we've given to the governor is a plan to reallocate an existing regional performance incentive program grant to provide startup funds for COGS and RESCs to offer services at that level that are currently being done by every individual town or district.
That's wonderful.
It dovetails nicely with what you
Yeah, it does. It dovetails well. And the state finance project is also coming forward with a funding proposal. I'm working pretty closely with Lisa Hammersley. We're not in conflict at all. Hers is just more expensive.
Right. Marcia.
Thank you. Thank you, Fran, so much for that overview. I'm truly, from being the perspective of a mayor of a distressed municipality and being yep. having not only the amount of funding that would be appropriate for each of our students, the allocation, but also having a significant of students leave and us having to fund them in magnet schools has also been impactful. Your overview of all of the changes that you believe could be beneficial certainly speaks to not looking at funding in isolation, but not also looking at services in isolation.
Correct.
Today, the school systems have the responsibility of the whole child. That yes. has grown significantly. And I think over the years, people have lost sight of that. It is not just about a regular school day. In our community, we have to worry about the homeless children. We have to worry about connectivity. We have to worry about them having food sustenance. We have to worry about shaping their future. We have to worry about their mental health and the mental health of their families and provide counseling services to them. When you talk about advocating, CAVE and the legislators and the education committee, I feel like your plan touches on every single committee at the Capitol. And if we really want to change how we educate our children, it's going to take the collective effort of every single commission.
Those are such wonderful words, and I agree with you. I mean, I spent an hour last week on the phone with Kathy Austin and appropriations and talking to her about how this is much more far-reaching than the education committee. And, she agreed, just said, you need to get more support, and I will definitely take a look at it. I also think, to your point, districts have been charged with so much, and when we talk about the mental health of children, for example, somehow or other, we do need more help at the district level, but we also need better ways of blending the community providers for mental health with the school district. I was, superintendent in Bridgeport. I needed someone to help me at 10 o'clock in the morning when the kindergartner had a breakdown and I didn't have a social worker in every school. How could we be less territorial about that and create more symmetry? So that's one of the things we're looking at as well, because certainly the responsibility has grown. I mean, look at the free and reduced lunch. Your municipalities are and school districts are suffering. They're trying to provide lunch and breakfast to everyone during this challenging time, which of course is a priority, but you're losing millions of dollars in that as well, and that is in the district accounts.
Thanks.
So thank you for that.
Yeah, thank you, Marcia and Fran, on that. Before what I, because we are kind of running a little bit late on time, what I was going to suggest was that, thanks to Bruce's wisdom, we have created a mechanism within ACIR to establish subcommittees with a regular meeting time for those subcommittees to get together and discuss particular items that the larger group has brought up. I'm wondering if this would be an appropriate topic to assign to a subcommittee to read through the CAPS report and recommendations and perhaps meet later on this month at the assigned subcommittee time to offer thoughts, comments, and develop those kinds of comments for the larger group to consider and draft a, you know, so that the larger group can endorse with whatever changes or recommendations we might have the plan that Fran has put forward. Does that make sense to folks as a possible next step in terms of our consideration of this proposal? I'm seeing some nodding heads.
Do you want a motion?
Yeah, that may be good if we could.
Sure. Then I'll make a motion endorsing what you suggested for the subcommittee to go into the details of the report and report back to the full body of ACIR at our next meeting.
I'll second that.
Great. Thanks.
And I will say, I will offer, guys, with that subcommittee, I will move mountains in my schedule because you are, you're just a group that I think can offer us a different perspective. And I will, you know, change my schedule if you want me at any of those subcommittee meetings.
Great. Thank you, Fran. We probably will take you up on that.
Okay.
I would imagine. So any other comments on the motion? And if not, let me try your minds. All those in favor of that motion, please signify by saying aye.
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 Okay. Any opposed or any abstentions? Okay. Great. Thanks. So what that means is that we will be creating a subcommittee within ACIR to review the CAPS report and proposal to offer our own input and thought back to the larger group so that potentially the larger group can then endorse this going forward. Fran, that sequencing of events will, assuming we can do this in one subcommittee meeting after we've all read through the report, our next regular meeting of the body is the first Friday of March. So maybe as early as then we could actually take a vote on that.
That would be wonderful. I so appreciate it. Thank you so much. And whatever I can help with, I'm here.
Great. Thank you, Fran.
Right.
This is really informative, and it's exciting, actually.
It is exciting, I think. All right.
Good stuff.
Thank you all. Thank you. Thank you for the good work you do.
Thank you, Fran. Same to you.
Bye-bye.
Okay, great. So that was helpful. Let me just get back to our agenda. I'm conscious of the time. We may be running over our usual adjournment time of noon, just to get to these things. The quick local government of the future update. Just, Martin, I don't know if you've got anything more on that. I know that the RPIP, our RPIP proposal, I think is still in the governor's proposed budget. Is that still in the offing?
Sure. Good afternoon, almost afternoon. So that ACR piece is being worked into governor's proposed bill, not part of the budget bill. It's it's a separate bill. On that is in the process being drafted. We are working with governor's office on that. So that should be coming out. I'm not sure when it will officially come out. A lot of the legislative proposals come out after the budget proposal, which is February 10th. So be on the lookout for that. But that, is in that process, and that's where it'll be.
Great. Thanks. We had Martin and Jonathan Harris and I had a meeting on Monday, I guess it was, just to kind of answer some other questions from the OPM secretary and clarify a few points. So it does seem like it's going forward. So thank you, Martin, for your help with that.
Yep,
In making that happen. So then the other LGF recommendation is the collaborative efforts among boards of ed that Lon has been spearheading. I know, John, you had proposed to the group some additional language, but we do want to, as of yesterday, but as the agenda indicates, there is a bill that has been introduced, which is SB 446. It's been introduced by Senator Needleman. Do we have to have some additional conversation about content based since our last iteration of this? Because I know we've had a lot of discussion about identifying the proper language for how we want to implement that. But can you, Lon, can you, or John, can you give us a status on that?
Yes, and I know John had some suggestion too, and I don't disagree with the suggestion about ensuring that we don't go down a road that we don't intend to go with collaborations and locking other districts out of a collaboration. I can't remember which meeting we had the language up on, so I could pull it up on screen real quick if that helps. Let me just put it up on screen if that works.
Sure.
Give me 1 second here, and I will share my screen. Host disabled screen. Okay, so actually, if you go and look at it doesn't let me share. If you go and look at 446 on the website, it's there now. And what we found was that there is a spot in the statute, in the current statutes, that define what a school district is. And so this would look at section 10-240. And that would essentially add this as an option. You know, that if school districts are working together under the cooperative agreement statute that exists already, which is 10-158A, that those boards could, you know, choose together to be recognized as a single district. And that's pretty much the language at the moment.
Right. And our language was actually, I think, a little bit more comprehensive than, you know, what Senator Needleman put in was, you know, is a concept bill, essentially. It does include statutory language, but are we in really what I'm asking is, are we in agreement yet on the specific language that we would like to see adopted in that bill? John, did you have a?
I was just going to say, you know, the bill's before the committee. It hasn't been raised for a public hearing or to be drafted at this point. And I don't know what conversations the senator has had with the leadership. So I think whatever suggestions we have for specific language, I would assume would be welcome, but never know.
Well, there's another variation on this, which we discussed at our last meeting, which was that, you know, usually our conduit for getting legislation introduced is the Planning and Development Committee. Of course, this is a purely education issue, and so it will fall into the jurisdiction of the Education Committee. But the chairman, as I mentioned earlier in the meeting, the chairman of Planning and Development was contacting me, I guess last week, to ask, you know, are there any other concepts that ACIR is raising, particularly on this education piece? And so the question is, do we want to have our own fully vetted language produced and then give that to the Planning and Development Committee, who then can do a straight change of reference over to education and have it be brought up in a public hearing? I see Betsy had advised us that there is a concept to be raised by the Education Committee next week. But in the meantime, do we want to have our own more specific language, you know, presented to P&D and have their LCO drafted up as a raised bill within the committee, but then have them change the reference over to education? I'm talking procedure here, but that was, I think we have done a lot of work in terms of vetting the actual language we think should be included in the bill. But if we're not ready to do that, we should also know that, so we can just maybe have it go on a rolling basis that the education committee takes it up. What's your thought on that?
My thought, Mr. Chair, is if P&D is willing to do that, if we have vetted language, we should proceed with the offer.
Okay. So do we have that language final? Are we comfortable with the language that we've been talking about thus far? Or is there still work to be done on that language? What do you think?
I don't know.
I, I don't have anything in my email, so I don't know if there was something else drafted. I just don't have it.
Okay.
I saw what John sent back in regards to ensuring that districts don't lock districts out of a potential agreement, which that was the only thing that I saw.
Yeah.
What I had done was add a sentence to it that would require the State Board of Education to promulgate regulations, in accordance with Chapter 54, so that for the establishment of a cooperative agreement and to ensure that such an agreement would result in cost savings, operational efficiencies, and not aggravate or add to racial or economic disparities.
Okay. And as a body, last meeting, we did endorse the overall concept here with the understanding that we may be making some tweaks to the language to make it either consistent or, identifying, the correct definition of what the school district is that we would be considering here. So, I don't think we need the full body to be revisiting tweaks in the language going forward. And if, Lon, you feel comfortable with a final product, what I would propose is that I hand that over to the planning and development chairs for them to include as a raised concept. Is that good with everyone? Are folks comfortable with that? Okay. Good. Okay, great. Well, Lon, if you could just give me, I've got a couple different versions also, but you've been the primary architect, so I want to make sure that I've got the language correct. So if you could just send me over the what you feel is the fully vetted version as far as we have it as of now, and then I'll forward that on to Representative McCarthy Bay and Senator Cassano.
Okay, great. Yeah, I will. I'll put together what I've got here, and we can work offline on that.
Great.
Okay. And then I think there was one concern on labor agreements, and I know that there's language in regards to how regional school districts form, and I think that process would be very, very relevant to this process because it's a very similar thing.
Right.
And I can look that up also.
Great. Any other thoughts or comments on that? All right. Terrific. I'm sorry, Lyle, did you? Okay. All right, good. Great. Well, then that's the meat and potatoes of our meeting today. I think that we've covered pretty promptly, actually. So moving on to item 7, are there any other matters for our consideration? And then we also want to talk about future discussion topics, which we'll get to in a minute. Is there any other thoughts on the other matters for our consideration? Under item 7, before we get to public comments, future discussion topics for March 5th at our next meeting. We have been talking, and I think, John, you've been also encouraging us to take a look at this whole question of the PSAP, the statewide PSAP system, which has been under discussion within DESPE. We have been talking about the potential of having a conversation about that at our next meeting. How's that? Is that still something that you think we can be doing?
Yeah, I think in particular, we're going to talk about the statewide radio system.
Yeah.
And that can...
I said PSAPs. I'm sorry, yeah.
Yeah. It's the same people, so I'm sure they can answer other questions on PSAPs too. But the technology actually assists in regionalizing PSAPs because you don't have a big cost barrier of replacing radios and doing new radio towers and all that. So it's maybe a baby step, but it's a huge financial benefit to all the emergency and non-emergency services. As I said last time, our public works department is now on. So yeah. I think we need to look at it as just not the PSAP, but this radio communication system is just impressive. And I think people need to know that the state does some very good things.
So are you, do you think it's good for us to have that on our agenda for next month? Do you think?
Yes, they're prepared. They would like to know kind of how long you want, 10 minutes.
Well, I'll say 15, you know.
Okay. So good. Now they've got it on their calendar, and so it'll be Bill Ewell from 911 Commission and Clayton Claybrook from the communication side.
Terrific. Great. Thanks, John. Thanks for putting that together. John Felchek, did you have a...
Yeah, along those same lines, the each of the nine cogs have been asked by the secretary as a condition of our funding for the last quarter to examine PSAPs along with regional assessment, and for each of us three additional areas that we're exploring as priorities for shared or regional services. So we are preparing through CTCOG, and sorry, Sam, I probably stole your thunder here, a collective report on that. So that would be timely because that report will be completed and we can share those results with you as well from the perspective of the COGS.
Great, thanks. And a thumbs up from Sam. So that's good. Any other thoughts on that, having that as our an agenda item in our next meeting? If not, also, I a couple people did point out that that subcommittee that we have formed on the CAPS proposal, I don't think we have to identify folks right now who would be on that subcommittee, but I think for those who would be interested in participating in that discussion and that subcommittee meeting, if you could just let let Bruce know that you would be interested in participating. I think that's that would be the best way to go on that. That's, that way we're not restricting anybody, but also not burdening anyone who's who's maybe not in the middle of that discussion. So with that, I'll go back to item 8. Sorry for the jumping around on the agenda, but if there are any public comments that anyone who's been listening in or participating virtually would like to make, feel free to raise your hand and be recognized. Okay. All right, seeing none. Our next subcommittee meeting then would be Tuesday, February 23rd at 10:30. Our agenda has a parenthetical comment if needed. It is needed. So plan on that subcommittee taking place for those interested in participating on Tuesday, February 23rd at 10:30 a.m. And then our next meeting of the full ACIR is next March 5th, that Friday, the first Friday of March. All right. So thank you for hanging in there. This was a good meeting and we got a lot done. Can I have a motion to adjourn?
So moved, Lyle Ray.
Second, Marsha LeClaire.
Thank you very much. Any discussion? Seeing none, all is in favor of adjournment, please indicate by saying aye.
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 All right. Thank you all for being on this, and we still have a lot of work to do as always, so we'll stay in touch as the month goes on. Thanks a lot. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Bye.